Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The number of new voters registering for this election is something that poll watchers and workers have never seen before. Take the example of Ohio, where 700,000 potential new voters have signed up, more than half from just the three cities of Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Columbus. Election officials talk about a sense of urgency, excitement in the land. And in many cases, they link it to the heat and the narrow margins of this race and to the memories of 2000, when just a few more votes might have made a difference. Okay, so that's the good news. The bad news is that memories of the election in 2000 are also bringing legions of lawyers into politics. Democrats and Republicans are sending tens of thousands of lawyers, legal SWAT teams, to watch the precinct stations. The lawyers are already arguing about the possibility of fraud and intimidation in the intricacies of the acceptability of each vote. So here's our question. How bad is this going to get? Are you in any way encouraged that the two parties are actually applying greater legal scrutiny? Or are you worried that the more the lawyers get their hands in, the less each vote is likely to count? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. A number of people joining us this hour, among them Heather Gerken, our expert in election law. But we want to start with two-party spokesmen in Ohio. Dan Trevis is communications director for the Ohio Democratic Party. He's joining us on the line along with his counterpart at the Ohio Republican Party, Jason Mock. Thanks for being with us, both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
And Dan, let me, if I can, start with you. The Republican Secretary of State, you need to help me with this, J. Kenneth Blackwell, has made a series of recent rulings saying that he's trying to manage the number of new voters, and the Democrats have challenged him in the court. What's he doing wrong? What's your principal complaint?
The principal complaint is that the Help American Vote Act wanted to make it clear that every voter who is eligible to vote gets a chance to cast a vote. There are technical errors, as we know. We're a state where 69 counties use punch cards. We've had election problems in the past. The federal law wanted to make it easier for people to cast their vote, and we believe the Secretary of State's directives try to put some confusion and some roadblocks in the way of that directive.
Jason Mock, from the Republican perspective, what's your version of what's going on there?
Well, I don't speak for the Secretary of State, but I do speak for the Republican Party, and our position is that there does appear to be some conflict between the Help America Vote Act and state election law, and Secretary of State Blackwell is simply trying to uphold state election law as he has in previous elections, and those are laws that have been on the books for a number of years. State law has allowed for provisional balloting in the past, and we have always followed the principle that provisional ballots can only be cast in the precinct in which the voter resides. Democrats have seemed to pursue a very litigious environment in the run-up to this election, which gives us great concern for their plans on Election Day itself. They filed lawsuits at every opportunity in recent weeks.
But they had one case that actually went against the Secretary of State, did they not, Jason?
Say that again?
There was one ruling, one judge's ruling, that went against what the Secretary of State's doing.
Yeah, the Toledo court did rule against the Secretary in one particular suit, but that ruling conflicts with other rulings that, of a similar nature in other states, such as Missouri, Colorado, and Florida, and it has been appealed to the Sixth Circuit. And there was another ruling filed against the Secretary of State by some Democratic allies that was actually turned down by the same judge, and he blocked it, basically claiming that had it been upheld, this would have broken down some of the safeguards put in place to prevent fraud.
Any concern there, Jason, that by taking these matters to court at any level or by anyone, that all these new voters somehow might get discouraged?
No, this is not an effort to disenfranchise voters. In fact, it's the other way around. We're seeking to eliminate the potential for fraud to prevent itself at the ballot box. And it's the Democrats really that are filing all these suits to break down the safeguards that have been put in place to prevent that fraud.
Okay, Dan Trevis, I want to come back to you, and I want to start, if I can, with a definition. When we're talking about provisional votes here, what we're talking about, if I get this right, is someone who's not on the list but still shows up at the precinct and is allowed to cast his or her vote with the proper identification. Yeah? Is that right?
That's exactly right.
So what's wrong with challenging the provisional vote? Isn't that a way of keeping people honest?
That's a very good way of doing it. And Ohio has a great system, unlike Florida. And let me just back up a second. Before we started filing litigation, we had our state senators and state representatives on committees working with the Secretary of State to try to implement the federal law. What I think the Republicans are forgetting is that we passed a federal law because of the confusion in Florida to try to clear up some of the mistakes that have been happening in the past. So we tried very hard to implement rulings, and now we're just being vindicated by the courts and saying all along we were right. This is how the federal law is supposed to work. Ohio did have a provisional law statute that worked good in state cases, and it was for a specific set of circumstances that state lawmakers had saw. It is not the same to say that's what's going to be happening in this federal election.
Dan, is this going to get worse before it gets better, the arguing about this in courts?
It potentially could, but, you know, my feeling is by the time we get to Election Day, it's going to get better. We're right now hashing out the ground rules of the game and what the law means and how this is supposed to work. And so I think it's going to get better because Ohio has a system of bipartisan boards of elections. Each county board of election has two Republicans and two Democrats, and each of them have the staffs of each board are half Democrat, half Republican. There's a checks and balance system for a long time in Ohio on how to count hanging chads, dimple chads. There's all kinds of rules and regulations already in for disputes. So simply, if you allow people to cast a vote, we have a good system for detecting fraud, but you can't detect fraud if you've shut the door to people and
okay,
not allow
okay,
them to
I'm
vote.
One more here for Jason Mock. And Jason, from the Republican perspective, is this going to go up to Election Day, or is this possibly going to go on after Election Day?
Well, I do agree with Dan on his take that this will get better. I think it's encouraging that these issues are being resolved prior to Election Day. I think both parties really want to ensure that every vote is cast and counted according to law. There is some discrepancy that needs to be worked out between existing state law and the new reforms that have been enacted at the federal level in the aftermath of the Florida recount. And that's what's being worked out right now. Our goal is to resolve these issues prior to Election Day so that on Election Day, it's a seamless process at the voting booth.
All right, Jason and Dan Travis, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Jason Mock is communications director with the Ohio Republican Party. His counterpart, Dan Travis, has the same job with the Ohio Democratic Party. Joining me in the Boston studio, Heather Gerken, assistant professor of law at Harvard Law School, a specialist in election law and voting rights. You're listening to the story from Ohio, and both our earlier guests, Heather, said things are going to get better. Are they going to get better?
Well, things may get better in Ohio on these issues, but I don't think things are going to get better as we get closer to the election. In fact, I think we are heading toward a train wreck. There are a number of problems in the swing states, the kinds of problems we saw in Florida, but we just have more Floridas this time. We have a vote that's likely to be close in at least five or six battleground states. So I think that the kind of litigation that you're seeing in Ohio is going to continue past the election if it turns out to be close, which it looks like it will be.
Both of those gentlemen referred to the Help America Vote Act. Some people call it HABA. It was the piece of legislation that came out of the disaster in the year 2000 and was passed by Congress and designed to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Well, that's what people would like to think. The truth of the matter is that due to partisan bickering, HABA wasn't enacted nearly soon enough. So the kinds of money that you would need to replace, for example, election machinery that HABA was supposed to provide didn't come until June of last year. The other problem is the act is basically toothless. There are a lot of things that they ask states to do, but there are very few ways to impose those requirements. For example, one of the things that everyone wanted was to have a fair registration list for everyone and new equipment in by this election. Mm-hmm. What it turns out has happened is almost every state has sought a waiver. So there are almost no states who are going to be in compliance, even with the most basic requirements of HABA, and they were fairly weak requirements to begin with.
So we've got all kinds of different ways of counting the ballots, including these 1950s lever machines. The hanging chads are going to be with us for another election in some cases. We know that. I want to go to one of the points that's at issue in Ohio, and this is understanding the provisional vote, because I hear in that the history of a very old argument between Democrats and Republicans over who has the right to vote in which precinct. Is it the same old argument all over again?
It is the same old argument. I mean, we can all agree on two things. One is that everyone ought to be able to cast a vote, and two, we don't want any cheating. The difference here is that the Democrats have a huge interest in getting as many voters as possible to the polls because they think that those people are likely to vote for Kerry. Similarly, the Republicans have a significant interest in not having everyone vote because they think that these new voters are more likely to vote for Kerry than Bush. So although both of them are making perfectly legitimate arguments about things that we all agree about, they're also self-interested. They have an investment in the outcome of these questions.
So has the Help America Vote Act then made things more complicated because it's requiring a new interpretation of how to handle these so-called provisional votes in states that are having to sort of come to terms with that at the last minute?
That's exactly right. The states are having to figure out how to reconcile the Help America Vote Act provisions with their own state law. In addition, to the extent that any money has gotten out into the system, a lot of these states are running their elections for the first time with new machinery. And running, you know, it's just like you always have a rehearsal for a play. You don't want the rehearsal to take place on the night of the actual election. So there are likely to be lots of problems, even with the new voting machinery that's out there.
You heard me at the beginning of the program saying that the good news was that there'll be all these new voters, and the bad news is that there'll be all these lawyers looking at the new voters. Now, you're a lawyer, and I want to sort of give you a chance to respond to that. It's kind of a knee-jerk reaction on my part to think, oh, my God, the lawyers seem to be so much a part of the problem in 2000. But in fairness, they were also the ones that eventually found a way out. A lot of people didn't like the solution that they came up with. When you look at where we are in 2004, are you pleased to see more people, more legal people, more lawyers involved?
I'm actually not pleased to see it because it's a sign of, I think, intense distrust in the system that's shared not only by lawyers who are familiar with election law, but by lots of different people. The problem is we're a fairly obstreperous bunch. It's a tribe that you don't exactly want wandering around the halls because we argue with one another. So as much as I think it's very useful to have lawyers in polling places, it's an essential a strategy for protecting people's ability to vote, it's also going to gum up the system. It's going to make some voters feel intimidated, and it's likely to make it much more difficult for polling place workers to do their jobs.
When lawyers gum up the system, though, they also slow things down. There's something positive in that, isn't there? Slowing things down when they get a little frantic and out of sync?
Absolutely. So there's two things that lawyers can do that are very, very useful. One is to help voters figure out what their rights are. So what happened in 2000 is a lot of people got to the polls, were told that they had to be turned away. Had there been a lawyer there, someone could have said, no, you can cast a provisional ballot, or here's how to fix the problem. That's all to the good. The other thing that lawyers can do is if there's a problem, for example, what we saw in Florida, that the machines don't start for 3 hours, lawyers can actually go to a court and say, we'd like to have the polling place open for a little bit longer, or we'd like to make other arrangements, and we want a judge to help us do that. So those are both things that lawyers can do immediately to fix the problem before it gets too big to be fixed.
Do you think when you wake up on November 3rd, you're going to know who the president is?
I doubt it very much. If I were a betting person, I would think that, in fact, we're not going to know for a couple weeks. Even just the question of provisional ballots, there were, I think, 100,000 provisional ballots cast in Ohio in 2000. Now, imagine that were the case this time. It seems quite likely that the race is going to come down to far fewer than 100,000 votes.
1-800-423-8255. You're looking at the election. You're listening to it through the eyes and the ears of the lawyers who are also looking at it. How do you think this one is going to be different? 2004, are we now on a course where the lawyers have an important and a key role in every vote that's cast in America? What does that mean for you, the voter? You're supposed to be the person in charge. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection this hour. We're talking about just how much of a mess this election might be with everything so close, so much confusion over new election rules and regulations, particularly in the swing states where, in fact, the decision could be just a few thousand votes and all those provisional votes and people voting where they're not supposed to or where they're allowed to. And the lawyers are going to have to sort that all out. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. Heather Gherkin's with me in the studio. She's an assistant professor of law at Harvard Law School and an expert in election law and voting rights. We're going to Lexington, Massachusetts for our first call. Pat's on the line. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Yeah, I took exception of when you initially characterized the presence of the lawyers as a bad thing.
Okay, fair.
I look at it as a chance to protect and defend the democracy. I mean, I am deeply sad that it has come to this, mm-hmm. and that I personally am afraid that the election will be stolen by bad practices. But
and are you thinking that lawyers are the only defense against that?
I think lawyers are one of the defenses. I think that we have to be very, very vigilant. I find it disgraceful that the political connections of state officials who are running the elections are so deeply deep and strong.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would like much more objective election officials, particularly if I'm thinking of Florida and Miami.
Heather's nodding along with you, Pat, as you're describing that.
So, Pat, you really put your finger on it. The crucial difference between the United States and almost every other Western democracy is this. Every other Western democracy virtually runs their elections with a professional, independent system. The problem in the United States is the problem we saw in Florida, where on the one hand, the Secretary of State, Katherine Harris, was chair of the Bush re-election campaign. And on the other hand, the Attorney General was the chair of Gore's election campaign. So what we have is people who are inherently self-interested. Their jobs depend on the decisions they're making. So even if we believe they're people of good faith, we cannot help but suspect that somehow their self-interest is going to taint what they are doing. That's precisely why you are right to be worried and why lawyers are going to be at every polling place they can be.
I'm wondering, though, whether or not you think we're at a point of transition, Heather, where the new voting hardware is eventually going to be in place. The states will have a chance to understand and adapt to the new laws that are coming from Washington. And that maybe by 08 or 12 or 16, it's going to work. But then when I listen to you talk about the partisan nature of sorting this out, I'm not so persuaded.
So even if we could fix the machinery, Dick, you're absolutely right. It's possible that a fix could be made. There's still many ways in which self-interested legislators essentially affect the way elections are run. They affect how their competition runs. And, for example, redistricting. There are almost no competitive districts in Congress this year. Why is that? Because state legislators are drawing those districts to make them safe for incumbents. Campaign finance. Again, legislators don't have an incentive to change the system. They got elected under the old system. So to have state legislators be in control of these kinds of decisions is a big problem. And just fixing the machinery is not going to cure that problem.
We were talking about it earlier in the program in Ohio. We know that there are challenges and legal arguments underway right now in Michigan, New Mexico, and Florida, New Hampshire, and also in the state of Colorado. We're joined now on the line from Colorado by David Harsanyi. He's a columnist with the Denver Post. Hi, David.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I saw some of your writing the other day. You were talking about slipshod restrictions on registration, potential voter fraud, and overtaxed election staff. Sounds like a potential mess where you live.
Well, as Heather said, I think it's a train wreck waiting to happen here. I think it's gotten a little better because Colorado Common Cause's lawsuit was basically shot down, which will make it a little harder for people just to fill out provisional ballots at will.
Now, one version of the Common Cause lawsuit that you're talking about that I heard was that people didn't need to show up with ID, people didn't need to say where they live, they could pretty well just show up and say, I'm a citizen, I want to vote. Have I got that wrong?
I think you have it exactly right. You wouldn't have to show ID, and you could show up at any precinct without ID. But two of the three points Common Cause made were shot down by the judge. I think there was a similar ruling in Florida, I believe.
Now, the Democrats also got themselves in some trouble in Colorado, talking about preemptive action, urging criticism of the Republicans even before there was anything to criticize. How's that playing out?
Well, I wrote a column on it. The head of the Democratic Party here said that he would rather have used the word proactive than preemptive, but it didn't look very good when you read it. It basically said that you should prime minority leaders to to send out press releases and complain about intimidation, even if there was no intimidation scene.
And as if they wouldn't do that or couldn't do that on their own without some assistance
exactly.
from the party. One more thing that has me completely baffled from Colorado, David, and I don't know whether or not you can help me with it, and that is the aspect of the vote on November 2nd where voters in Colorado are going to have a chance to say how the Electoral College votes for that state might in fact be, how the use of those votes might be changed.
Yes, Amendment 36. I don't believe it will pass. It's a retroactive amendment that would kick in this election, split the Electoral College vote. Lawyers on the
split it based on the proportion of who gets how many votes? Or
yes,
yeah, okay.
Exactly. The Republican lawyers here have told me, and there are lawyers everywhere, have told me that they don't think that that will stand up. They'll take it to the Supreme Court. I don't think most Democrats here have come out against it, including Ken Salazar, who's running for the Senate. It doesn't have a lot of popular support in the state.
David, just one more from you, if I can. You work as a columnist in Denver. You study these issues all the time. That's your job. I wonder whether or not you've got a good fix on exactly what's going to happen on the 2nd and how easy it's going to be for voters to make their way through.
In what sense?
Well, it sounds like it's getting more rather than less complicated.
Well, I think the main problem here is the provisional ballots. They're sequestered afterwards and then counted. I think it, when provisional ballots start being thrown out, lawyers on the Democratic side will point and say, look, there's a disenfranchisement going on here. With such lax sort of making it so easy to walk in and fill out a provisional ballot leads to a lot of problems in my book. So I think that we need an orderly election here, and that's the most important thing.
Are you going to get it?
So far things have gone well in early voting.
Yeah.
I believe that we're going to have problems here. I've asked many of people on both sides, how can people cheat here? And they've never explained it to me. I don't think it's possible. I think when the provisional ballots are checked, the right vote will be counted. But I think it's going to be filled with lawsuits.
David, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
David Harsanyi is a columnist with the Denver Post, joining us on the line from Denver, Colorado. 1-800-423-8255. We will get to some of the things that he's put on the table, but I do want to get back to our callers. We're going next to Crestwood, Kentucky. Harry's on the line. Hi, Harry.
Yes, sir. How are you today?
I'm fine. And you?
Fine, thank you. I have a comment I'd like to make. Mm-hmm. I think it's amazing that with the technology and the know-how in this country, we can send men to the moon, we can make machines, send them into outer space, and they can come back. But we can't figure out a way to make a voting machine that works. And, you know, you've got this lawyer on the line there and talking about the law. I think it's kind of funny that a lot of your politicians are lawyers, and it's to their advantage to not have a good system in place for us to vote.
Or to try and change it every single time they get a crack at that, Harry? Is that a part of it? I don't know. What do you think?
It's something that we've been trying to figure out for quite some time. We finally realized that we have a serious problem back in 2000, and it's going to really affect our country, our method of government, our constitution, everything this time, I'm afraid. It's going to be a mess, and it's no reason for that to happen. You know, they've got 10,000 lawyers lined up to argue this thing, and November the 3rd, we won't know who the president is. That's just amazing to me. And, you know, I'm not trying, it's not a question, it's not a complaint, it's just a comment. I'd like someone to respond to that, and I'll take any action off there.
I thank you for your call.
So Harry's exactly right. I mean, it just seems ridiculous that we haven't fixed the machinery in 4 years. Up until 2000, people didn't really know what was going on. That is, what happened was communities all across the country had a choice. Buy new machinery, build a playground. Buy new machinery, hire another teacher. Buy new machinery, put some more cops in the beat. For them, it seemed like an easy question because there was no crisis. Now, though, that we've seen the crisis, it's inexcusable, in my view, that state and federal officials have not taken the steps necessary to fix this problem. And I think Harry's exactly right to be angered about it.
And should Washington have put more money or more urgency behind this? Would that have made any difference? Or really, does this rest on the doorsteps of the state officials?
It rests on both doors. I have to say, I think Washington just fell apart here. What happened was, because the election was so controversial last time, neither side wanted to give an inch on the issue. So the Democrats wanted to use it as a tool to attack the legitimacy of Bush presidency. The Republicans were unwilling to agree to any reform for fear that it would do exactly that. It reached exactly that result. So as a result, they bickered for years before they were able to actually produce something. And what they produced was almost useless.
There is in one of the things that David was talking about from Denver, the seed of an idea which I find interesting but at the same time enormously confusing, and that is any suggestion that electoral college votes would be tied to the votes that people cast. Is this an idea that's real, or is this just more obfuscation?
No, it's actually a very interesting idea. The problem is the Electoral College, the 12th Amendment, works in a sort of counter-majoritarian way. That is, you can actually win the Electoral College and not win a majority of the votes, as happened in 2000. And this goes back to sort of an outdated conception of democracy of the framers. Alexander Hamilton said of the 12th Amendment, if it was not perfect, that it was nearly so. And remarkably enough, that's not the reason that Aaron Burr shot him. So the problem is we have an amendment that's difficult to change. The best hope of reform right now for people who want to make this more majoritarian is to do exactly what Colorado is doing, which is to allocate its votes in a proportional way. You get 50% of the votes, you get 50% of the Electoral College votes. The problem is, though, that states have very different incentives on this question. So because you have a winner-take-all system, if you're the dominant party in that system, you don't want to share those votes. You want to keep those votes. So the dominant party in every state will be reluctant to pursue this reform, which means that in the long term, it seems fairly unlikely to happen.
It's a good idea, but it's never going to happen.
Exactly, right? Unless it's done by initiative.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. To Van Horn, Iowa, Tom's on the line. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Mr. Gordon. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a question and a comment. My comment first is what Harry said from Kentucky about the technology we have. I don't know if you folks are familiar with the, I think it's a 26-state Powerball lottery. When those people buy a ticket, you know, like the next day, somebody in Connecticut or somebody in Iowa or somebody in Michigan won.
Funny thing about that, isn't it?
Why can't we do that? This is a heck of a lot more important than somebody winning a lottery. But my question is, the litigation that's going on before the fact, the gentleman you had earlier talking about with the lawyers and the trial lawyers, which get hammered on all the time,
yep,
on the campaign trail. Unless you're in trouble, when you're in trouble, you need a trial lawyer. But besides that, why don't we do it beforehand instead of after the fact, like in 2000, when the president wasn't decided on until the trial lawyers, I think some of them are, our Supreme Court justices, our lawyers, and probably some of them were trial lawyers before they were appointed to the court. They finally decided to stop the recount and to more or less appoint a president, or stop it and let it lay where it was.
Your point, Tom, is that all of this could have been sorted out long in advance of this particular moment, right?
Yes, sir. And my other point is that with all the lawyers on both sides watching the polls on Election Day, November 2nd, I think it's great because it preempts any problem or a lot of problems after the fact, because they're going to be watching, they're going to be waiting in case there's any improprieties on either side in any district, or hopefully any district, they will be there to try and start ironing it out when it happens or as it happens, instead of waiting till the next day and somebody has, you know, sour grapes about what happened.
Okay, Tom, I thank you for your call. Reminder, you're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. And Heather, when Tom talks about all the lawyers who are going to be watching everything that unfolds and reminds us again that maybe there is a measure of protection in that, should we get used to elections that take 10 days, 2 weeks to find out who won? Is this going to become the norm?
I hope it's not going to become the norm. I mean, Tom is really onto something, which is it is better to get these problems resolved in advance for the following reason. In advance, you don't know whether it's going to affect the election. The problem with Bush versus Gore is that everyone knew to a certainty that what the Supreme Court decided would determine who was president. It would have been far better for them to have issued a decision about recount standards beforehand. Now, there's various reasons why that's hard to do, but Tom's instinct that it's much better to make these decisions when you're blind to the result than after the election has taken place, when you know what the result will be, is exactly right, I think.
Now, if I was on one side or the other here, and I was going to hire you to work for me, saying, you know, we're actually going to use whatever legal means we can to tip this in our favor, would you be going back to exactly the same point that was argued in Florida about treating each ballot exactly the same? I mean, that's what that one turned on. And I wonder if we're anywhere past that.
Oh, absolutely. I think that there's a Bush v. Gore challenge embedded in almost every state, because what you see is essentially a patchwork. Standards for counting provisional ballots, for counting ballots, for recounting, even vary from county to county, let alone from state to state. So it is absolutely clear similarly situated ballots will be treated differently in this election. And the question is whether someone's going to raise a ruckus about that fact.
Just a question of clarification. If there is a provisional ballot cast in some particularly close precinct, and a provisional ballot, just to remind people who are joining us later, is one cast by someone who shows up. They're not on the rolls, but they get to vote anyway because they've got the proper ID. Now, are those ballots put into the box along with everything else, or are they kept to one side and counted in any way that's different?
They're kept to one side, and they're counted actually after the sort of first count comes through. Partially that's because you may not need to count them. But in fact, it's in part because you have to actually do some verification to figure out what happened and whether the vote was correctly cast as a provisional ballot.
So if it's not close, it might be that my provisional ballot is never even open, never even counted.
Absolutely. I mean, I think they will count it because eventually everyone wants to know the total, but no one will care at that point.
And doesn't that, though, take us back to treating each ballot exactly the same?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's some sort of deeper concern here, which is that if we really respect our democracy, we ought to respect every vote. And so that's why people find the sort of haphazard way that we're treating ballots in some ways disrespectful of democracy itself.
So what would work there? Just to take the provisional ballots, put them in the box with everything else, make the decision before the piece of paper goes in the box that, yes, we're going to count that, and we're not going to challenge it or question it later on.
Right. That would be the ideal way to do it. And if you actually had statewide registration lists that were computerized and easily accessible, that would be easy to do. Unfortunately, not one of the states that we're talking about has actually gotten their statewide registration list together yet.
And again, that's because there are partisan fingers in the pie in each case, where in some places it's worth their while to slow that down, in other places they want to speed it up.
Part of it is partisanship, part of it is lack of resources, and part of it is that Congress has waited too long to impose this requirement. So it's not surprising that these states couldn't get themselves together to meet these requirements by 2004, because Congress knew that. They actually let all these states get an extension for quote-unquote good cause. So the states are taking advantage of that provision.
All right. November 2nd, that is voting day, but is that going to be the day before the day we know who's the next president of the United States? How long is it going to take? And do you fault the politicians who've been in office for the past 4 years, who in effect got orders from the rest of the country to make sure that this didn't happen again? Have they let you down? Have they let you down at the state level? Have they let you down at the federal level? Are you worried that the votes will in fact count for less in 2004, with the court so much a part of the process? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Listening to The Connection. My name is Dick Gordon. Are you in any way encouraged that as the two parties apply greater and greater legal scrutiny to the election rules that are ahead of us and the voting day that is ahead of us, that things in fact might work a little bit better, or some of the problems we had in 2000 may be bypassed, or are you afraid it's going to be even worse than it was in 2000? Heather Gerken's here with me in the studio. She's a specialist in election law and voting rights and an assistant professor of law at Harvard. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Burlington, Vermont for our next call, and Robert's joining us. Hi, Robert. What do you think?
Hi. Well, I'm kind of indignant like the first guy that called in from Kentucky or wherever, except my problem is it's not that it's a technological thing, but a political problem. I think that it's ridiculous that in this century we do not have national standards throughout the entire country about who should be registered and who should not be, or how they get registered. We should have it shouldn't matter whether you're in Alaska or Florida. It should be the same rules. You should have the same voting machine. In my opinion, the optical scan voting machines are the ones that have the best track record in terms of reliability and And what's very, very important about that is that the ballots that you mark actually have the candidate's name on the ballot, so that when if they are manually recounted, or it's meaningful that you can tell exactly what the voter intended by looking at the ballot. Whereas the punch cards machine, if there's a misalignment of the punch card, you don't know what that hole meant. You don't know what the voter intended when that hole was punched, because the candidate's name is not on the actual ballot itself.
Robert, with your permission, what I'd like to do is begin where you began on this question of national standards. I mean, I think it's a really interesting way of looking at it. And I don't know, Heather, whether or not the original Help America Vote Act was a step in that direction, was it?
That Robert's exactly right, that that's what we need. And the Help America Vote Act was supposed to be a step in that direction, but it just got so watered down by the end of it that it really made not much difference at all. And there's certainly no question that Congress could regulate, at least for federal elections, how they are conducted. So the kind of thing that Robert is thinking about, national standards for all of these rules, different kinds of national standards for machinery, those are all accomplished should Congress actually vote on it.
Okay, so but they did vote on something in 2002. Does it leave the country with a foundation, a basis to work on something new?
Well, it's certainly a precedent. That is, it's a sense that Congress can regulate here, that it's an acceptable thing to do. There's just a lot of work to be done in this regard.
And I don't want to completely ignore the point that he was making about the voting machines and the ones that work and the ones that don't. You can get completely lost in web chat rooms and arguments about those. Is there any kind of agreement that, hey, there's a machine that works, could we please just use that one?
Because no one wants punch cards or lever machines. The fight is between the optical scan machines, which have all of the benefits that Robert talked about, and the electronic machines. And the reason why some communities favor the electronic machines is either because they have so many people who speak different languages mm-hmm. that it's difficult to provide the optical scan ballots, or because of people with disabilities. A lot of people think that the electronic machines are easier for people with disabilities to use. So therein lies the problem. It's, again, different groups have different views on this question because of the community they're representing.
And is that why we are never really likely to get to a state of national standards, because communities of people, wherever they are in Utah and Michigan and South Carolina, are never going to agree on even some of these basic principles?
Well, that's what politics is about. And at some point, someone's going to have to reach a compromise. And the job we give to our congressional representatives is to reach a sensible compromise when people disagree. They haven't done that. They haven't done that for partisan reasons. And they ought to be held accountable for it.
All right. We're going back to the phones, this time to Raleigh, North Carolina. Chris is with us. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I had a question in regards to people who register to vote that are not born or naturalized citizens of this country. What has been done in the past, or has anything been done to try to prevent this fraud from happening, or what can we do on the state level, if need be, to prevent this?
You're talking about anyone who is not a legal voter,
Correct. Right? Correct, and they register to vote within the frame, you know, the deadline, they register to vote, but they're not legally given that right to vote.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm a Canadian citizen. I can't vote in this country, but I have a driver's license. I have a social security number. If I showed up with those two pieces of identification, could I vote?
Well, there are lots of protections that are designed to avoid just that problem. The only trick is actually there are some very small communities that allow non-citizens to vote in local elections, so it gets particularly tricky there. But the sort of specter of non-citizens voting, I think, is a little bit of a mistake to think it's actually happening in a widespread way. There's no documentation or evidence to suggest that there's this huge problem with non-citizens voting. The bigger problem is actually people who are citizens who try to cast a vote for the first time and just aren't able to do so because of either language problems or something like that.
1-800-423-8255. Again in Raleigh, North Carolina. And Jim's with us. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
So?
After the last presidential election, I decided to sort of try it out for myself, and I applied to be a poll worker. And I'm not registered with either political party and never have been. And I was told by the Board of Election official that in my precinct there was a vacancy available that they'd not been able to fill for 3 years with that position. And they'd love to put me in there, but that they would first have to go back to the two individual party heads and ask them to be appointed to that position. And that because it was a predominantly Democratic precinct, that the Republican would probably be thrilled because they hadn't been able to find a Republican to fill that position, but that the Democratic person might not approve me because of my status as an independent.
And what happened?
I was approved and allowed to go ahead and do that, but I thought it was kind of appalling that, you know, I volunteered as a citizen to go do this, and I had to be approved by the head of one or the other of the two parties in order to be able to work at an election site.
Jim, this is exactly the problem that we have everywhere in this election. That is, the foxes are guarding the hen house. The people who are most self-interested in the outcome are determining tiny little decisions like who gets to be a poll worker, up until how we redistrict, how we run campaign finance, how we run our election system. It's a huge problem, and it's one that we're just not talking enough about.
Do you think, Jim, that this is in fact really where we ought to start when it comes to reforming national elections?
Yeah, I think that the parties, you know, the parties are talking about having attorneys at the elections and policing them. My God, they wrote the rules. I mean, they're policing their own rules, and so if they don't like it, it's kind of a partisan result, but they're partisan rules to begin with. I think that the parties have too much control over how the elections get run in the first place.
And when you talk with friends and neighbors about this, is there a consensus? I guess what I'm wondering is if this was actually put to voters in some kind of fashion, and that might be more difficult than we imagine, do you think voters are ready for this kind of detaching the system from the parties that stand to benefit from it?
Well, I think the average voter, like myself, believes that it is, in fact, you know, independent, that the Board of Elections, for example, has no ties and wouldn't pick up the phone and wouldn't call the party heads with regard to the staffing of individual poll sites.
Is that your understanding as well?
I think that's right. I think that we as a nation spend a lot of time obsessing about election outcomes, but we don't give nearly enough thought to the structure that leads to those outcomes. And every choice you make about how you conduct a campaign will end up having an effect on the outcome, whether Nader gets on the ballot, who runs, with what money, and so on. So all of the decisions Jim is talking about are really affecting the kinds of candidates we see and the choices that we have. And it's about time we start a conversation about that.
1-800-423-TALK to Boston next. And Wendy's on the line. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. I actually am a Florida voter, but I'm up in Boston doing a master's. And I thought it might be instructive to just let you know a little bit about what my experience was like trying to be an absentee voter in Florida, and I also have a question. It was difficult, and one of the reasons it was difficult was because when I went to the state, Florida State Gov website, and it gives you a list of telephone numbers for, I'm in Broward County, for the different, Brenda Snipes, I can't remember what her position is. At any rate, the phone number there rang and rang and like 20 times. And when I went and did it again, it didn't work either. I ended up calling the Kerry campaign, who had another number and connected me in. And actually then the service was great. I didn't have my voter registration with me, and they were, and the, you know, the people at.
But you had Democrats helping you get that ballot in there. You didn't have election. You didn't have impartial election officials.
Right, and what I thought was particularly interesting was that, you know, place all of the campaigns and stuff are they're sending out apparently millions of ballots themselves rather than fixing the problem in Florida. At least this is what I understand from talking to people, down there. I got to say, in terms of doing the balloting, having a hard copy to look at and think through was really wonderful and better than doing it the other way.
So you did get to vote, though, Wendy.
I did get to vote, and I sent it. I don't know if it'll work, but I sent it at registered return receipt. So at least I knew it got there. And so my question is about the NPR was running something at least locally yesterday about the students on campus and how many, you know, there's some argument here, at least, about trying to get them a voting machine on their campuses rather than playing the game of their permanent residences at their parents.
Okay, I'm going to ask Heather about that. I thank you for your call, Wendy. You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon.
So I'll start with the second question first.
Yeah.
There is a great deal of controversy over students voting because a lot of places try to discourage students from voting.
They're such troublemakers.
They are troublemakers, and people have a good guess about how they're going to vote. But it turns out there are these sort of obscure provisions, federal provisions, that require universities to actually facilitate student voting. Almost no university complies with them. So here again, we have an under-enforced statute. And Wendy's correct that people who are overseas, people who are trying to vote out of state, often encounter the kinds of problems. It may not be that the folks in the county she's talking about were trying not to answer the phone. They've been overwhelmed. These poll workers have been overwhelmed working 24/7 to just deal with the new registration. So they are vastly understaffed. So sometimes, you know, there's maybe partisanship, but a lot of the times it's simply either sort of an incompetent planning or inadequate staffing.
It's not necessarily, though, a bad thing to have the party involved in helping people vote, which is, in fact, what happened in Wendy's case. She turned to the party that she, and I'm assuming she's a Democrat, and that's why she had them helping. But, you know, if we think about polling day, parties organize these great get-out-the-vote campaigns. They'll drive people who, you know, who don't have wheels to vote, that sort of thing. I mean, at some point, we have to give the parties some right to get their people's votes in there, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they're generating energy. They're organizing communities. It's very it's a very good process. I'm completely happy to have the parties involved in that, provided that they play by the rules. The problem is simply in counting the ballots and running the election machinery. That's the place where the parties should have their hands out of it.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Let's see where we're going next. To Louisville, Kentucky. Brett's with us. Hi, Brett.
Bob Brett, thank you for taking my call, Mr. Gordon. My question is, there seems to be an undercurrent in this program of derision, possibly, of the lawyers, and because they seem to be the one policing that. And I am a lawyer, so. But my question is, if lawyers are not going to be the ones to do it, who would you or your Heather suggest be the appropriate substitute?
A lawyer. Heather's a lawyer. I'm going to let her answer the question, Bob.
Sure. No, Bob, I think that lawyers are doing a great service to the country by showing up and helping out with polling places. I'm just sad that it's gotten to that we need the lawyers to step in, because these problems should have been fixed a long time ago.
Tell me if you think, though, Heather, that with all the enthusiasm, all the excitement, all the new voter registrations, I mean, there are going to be problems when you get that many new faces and new names on pieces of paper. There are going to be cases of fraud. There are going to be reasons to take this to the court. Is there a part of you that worries that the more the lawyers get involved, the less engaged voters are in the process, that they think to themselves, you know, it's going to be Warren Christopher and James Baker that sort this out in the long run, so why should I bother?
I mean, that was my worry, actually, from 2000. That is, we were all sitting in our seats watching on television as the lawyers essentially argued what was going to happen with our democracy. I would have liked to see more grassroots energy directed towards the outcome. My suspicion is that would happen this time, that there'll be people are really energized about this election, they're excited about it, and they're going to feel like they ought to have a say. So yes, it would be a mistake for voters to think of themselves as passive participants in this endeavor. This is not the lawyer's game. This is the voters'.
But do the voters have anything to say after the 2nd of November?
Well, there's lots of different ways of asserting pressure. The untold story of Florida was that there was an on-the-ground war by the Republicans. They had much better on-the-ground lobbying, and they went county by county and put pressure on county officials to count military and overseas ballots, and it worked. So there was many ballots counted through that as through the lawyering.
All right, so November 2nd, you're not done on that day. Heather, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Heather Gerken is Assistant Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. Earlier in the program, we heard from Dan Trevis from the Ohio Democratic Party, Jason Mock from the Ohio Republican Party, and David Harsanyi, columnist for the Denver Post. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.